All right, the first matter we have up this morning is docket number 63189. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. I'm going to let you do that. Counsel, are you ready?
I am.
Okay. And if you would please pronounce that for me.
May it please the court, Heidi Perry Stern on behalf of appellant Mrs. Chen. What happened in this case is the probate commissioner allowed a foreign judgment to recognize, 40 years later, a marriage ceremony that was never claimed in Nevada and that would never be recognized in Nevada. And the probate commissioner allowed this foreign judgment to strip Mrs. Chen of her property, her livelihood, her family home, and her, from her perspective, her dignity as a married woman that she had enjoyed for over 30 years. This result, particularly when it came as a result of summary judgment in the face of clearly disputed facts, violates the public policy of the state and it must be reversed and remanded for consideration of those facts. Nevada courts need to proceed with caution when they apply foreign law, particularly when they apply that foreign law to deprive Nevada citizens of their rights and their property. No such caution was taken here.
Counsel, let's go into this. Talking about the foreign judgment. The foreign judgment was asked to validity of marriage one. Didn't really deal with the property in question here, even though it has ramifications. Aren't we compelled, if there was a modicum of proper procedure, due process, and things of that nature, giving the parties an opportunity for this to be given some weight as to status? And I do note that wife number two was not involved in the proceedings in Taiwan as to the legitimacy of marriage one.
I would respond with 2 points, Your Honor. One, Nevada courts are not obligated under the doctrine of comity to give credence to that order. However, if they choose to give credence to the order, they should follow the recommendation of the restatement of conflicts of law, section 98, which is cited in the briefs, which says that that foreign ruling is limited to the parties that were in front of it and the issues that were actually decided in that ruling.
So are we supposed to just put our head in the sand, though, as to that relationship and the validity and not recognize that there had been a prior marriage?
Under the doctrine of comity, that is certainly a possibility, Your Honor. That does not need to be the outcome. Here, on remand, the court can consider the disputed issues of fact. It can look at the Taiwanese court rulings, look at what they actually decided, look at the facts that were actually relevant to that decision, and apply them here. Now, once the court does that, let's assume, Your Honor, that the court does take into consideration that foreign ruling. We still have, and it finds, let's say further, that the court finds that my client's marriage to Mr. Chen is void or voidable based on that ruling. There still exist disputed issues of fact. Summary judgment under those circumstances was still inappropriate. And that's because of the putative spouse doctrine. Two reasons, really. The putative spouse doctrine, but the broader underlying obligation of the district court to consider equitable distribution of property. That was the obligation that the court was under here, and there were many disputed facts with regard to that.
And it would be helpful if you point that out to us as to your position of inappropriateness of summary judgment. There are some issues about the position as to putative spouse. The records seem to be soft in terms of both sides, providing the court with what they invested, so to speak.
Yes. Excuse me, Your Honor. Okay. So first, with regard to what they invested, there are disputed facts with regard to that. Was this property, was the genesis of the property here even community property? That's in dispute. We have evidence in the record showing that Mr. Chen, not respondent, was the actual owner of the home, the Tae Hui home is what I'm going to call it, which respondent alleges was the genesis of the community property here. There's no evidence that disputes her account in her affidavit that she was partially the owner, that she contributed money. In addition to that, the Taiwanese court actually states in its ruling, one of the Taiwanese courts, that Mr. Chen purchased that home. And then he's then listed as the owner. There's nothing in the record other than her affidavit saying that she also contributed to that home. So that issue is in dispute as well. And my client also submitted evidence that she contributed money, not towards the Take We home, but towards purchasing the eventual property in Nevada. So under Nevada law, there is a question as to whether that's community property. In Taiwan at that time, and even now, there's no default community property. There was no indication that when that home, the Take We home, was sold, that it became community property automatically. Those funds, from the evidence in the record, certainly appear to be separate property of Mr. Chen. So that's in dispute. In addition, going back to the putative spouse doctrine or the broader equitable distribution, the good faith of my client has been disputed by a respondent. Now, good faith under the putative spouse doctrine is presumed. So if there's no evidence of her not having good faith, her good faith is presumed. Certainly her actions over the course of her marriage with Mr. Chen indicate that she was in good faith. And the many equitable factors of her holding herself out as married, them registering their marriage, her presenting herself as married, go towards that good faith. So what I would say, though, is respondent puts this into issue, her good faith. But if you look at the portion of the record that they cite for that proposition, the Taiwanese court found her to not be in good faith. It's at page 74 of the record. That section actually talks about Mr. Chen's relatives knowing of the marriage between him and respondent and trying to pay her some money as a result of it. It does not mention Mrs. Chen at all. So going back to what the disputed facts are here. So we have the disputed facts with regard to the putative spouse. We have the disputed facts with regard to whether this was even community property, a presumption that the probate commissioner made without further evidence. We also have the fact of the legal status of the Chen's marriage. That in itself was in dispute. The probate commissioner never found, as a matter of fact, that the Chen's marriage was void. That finding was never made. It also was never made in the Taiwanese courts. Those courts were never called upon to consider that issue. Mrs. Chen was not a party to those proceedings, and they never made any ruling whatsoever as to the status of the Chen's marriage. Now, again, respondent has said that they did, but if you look at that page of the record, page 54, there's no finding, not even in dicta, that the Chen's marriage was void. And we've cited in our reply brief, as the court knows, a significant Taiwanese law indicating there's a dispute as to the voidness of that marriage. So moving on, what should have happened here? What should the probate commissioner have done? Certainly the probate commissioner should have been willing to look at the disputed facts, should have been willing to consider them and come to an equitable resolution of this matter. But most of all, the probate commissioner should have rejected Ms. Chang's claim as too late and too prejudicial.
Let me move you forward a little bit in the remaining time you have. You've talked a little bit about the probate commissioner, what he did or didn't do. And if this is a typical situation before the district court judge who has the question of whether they affirm or deny the ruling of the probate commissioner, what was the objection to the district court and how did you articulate that?
The objection was based on essentially the same three legal principles that we articulate today on appeal and arguing that there were disputed facts with regard to those issues, particularly the putative spouse doctrine, I would say was a major factor. So we objected on the basis that the court had basically written Mrs. Chen out of its order. That's the general way that I would describe our objection. Now, what happened in the district court is the district court said at the hearing that it had to give, it basically did not apply de novo review. It said that it had to give discretion to the probate commissioner and it had to abide by what the probate commissioner had found. Now, on summary judgment, that certainly shouldn't be the case. This court has de novo review over what happened below and can reconsider the facts anew and recognize the disputes that do exist in order to remedy what happened here. So what should the probate commissioner have done? It should have dismissed it as too late and too prejudicial. I know that this court and many courts don't necessarily like to apply laches to cases because it feels like taking away the rights of a party. However, in this case, the three requirements of laches are absolutely met.
Were those pled in the answer to the complaint that was brought?
I don't know, Your Honor. I would have to check that, and I will.
And we have a secondary issue that I know in the answer to the complaint that was brought. Putative spouse or even the doctrine wasn't raised. It was raised in the summary judgment motion, though.
I believe that was when it was raised. I don't think it was raised in the answer to the complaint.
No, it was not.
No, I don't think so. I will go ahead and save my remainder for rebuttal, unless the court has further questions for me.
I do have one question.
Yes.
We have, talking about the home that was purchased, is there any indication as to how much, if any, community property had gone into the purchase of that home?
Are you talking about the Nevada home?
Yes.
The windmill home.
Yes.
The only evidence given was in the affidavit of respondent, but she has no personal knowledge of what money went into purchasing that home, nor does she allege that she has any personal knowledge. So really, that's the only evidence there of how that home was purchased.
Thank you.
Although it was purchased, Your Honor, in joint tenancy. So that does give some indication as to how the parties, Mr. and Mrs. Chen, not the parties, but Mr. and Mrs. Chen, intended for that property to be dealt with, was as a joint tenancy rather than community.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Brian Egan on behalf of respondent Wensu Chang. The lower court absolutely and correctly entered summary judgment in this case because, one, there was no genuine issue of material fact that respondent was married to the decedent as shown by the Taiwanese court judgments. Two, that there was community property in Nevada that needed to be divided as between respondent and the decedent. Three, neither appellant nor decedent before her presented any timely or competent evidence to rebut the presumption that the respondent had anything other than a full one-half interest in that property. And four, that there was no legal or factual basis to apply either laches or the putative spouse doctrine to strip away respondent's rights in that one-half.
Wasn't there some indication the respondent had contributed money to this home here in Las Vegas?
There was an indication, Your Honor, that she contributed money to the home in Taiwan that she shared with the decedent, that home was in turn sold, the proceeds of which were used to acquire the motel business here. So basically, it's not so much, it's a derivative, it's derived from that business. And basically, there was nothing ever presented to rebut that by the appellant or the decedent before her.
But nothing with regard to the home here. There was no claim. There was no indication, no indicia that there were other funds other than his funds that went to purchase this home here.
No, just the presumption under the law that anything acquired during the marriage would be presumed to be community property.
Okay.
Counsel, there's the probate commissioner seems to come to some conclusions about the putative nature or lack thereof. But it's really not articulated as to why, and no case authority is cited in the order that we have before us as to why they came to that conclusion. Should that not be a concern to this court?
No, Your Honor. And the reason why is because as a matter of law, the putative spouse doctrine does not apply to this case. And there's a number of reasons for that. We haven't been able to find a single case that would suggest that a putative wife could somehow absorb a legal wife's interest in community property. It's never been used that way.
Well, counsel, I'm not necessarily looking for an all or nothing absorption, but in our law, a putative spouse, if they are in fact a putative spouse, are given some rights. So why was that not considered? I'm just flabbergasted. We have a statement. There's no case law to point to this. I see nothing in here to really articulate this point. being kind to both sides, we do have this dispute that the gentleman decided to get married twice, valid, invalid. He did this, and we have this mess.
I think the case law upon which appellant relies does offer a glimpse as to why that would not have been considered. The case law that they rely upon, basically, it supports the reading of our interpretation of the law, which is basically that the only claim that a putative spouse has is against the husband in question in this case. The putative spouse does not have a claim against the legal spouse, and she never made that claim. And the reason why is because under the most favorable application of the putative spouse doctrine, she received everything she would be entitled to receive and more. If you look at the cases upon which they relied, in particular the Hafner case actually talks, it chastises the opposing counsel, the counsel that's representing the putative spouse, for overgeneralizing the putative spouse doctrine. In that case, in oral argument, they made the representation.
But counsel, unlike that case, the probate commissioner just totally disregarded that doctrine based upon the statement in the order.
Your Honor,
it will not interfere. The language couldn't have been any stronger.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but it is our position that as a matter of law, the doctrine doesn't apply here. And it doesn't as a matter of fact either. I mean, the fact is that you need to come, if you're going to make a claim under putative spouse doctrine, you have to have clean hands. And there's nothing in the record at all that would dispute the fact that the appellant did not have knowledge of this relationship. Your Honor, I just have to point out that they...
Counsel, there were no facts in the record that indicated that she did either, so we're at a wash there. Why don't you address the primary issue that really confronts this court, and that is, do we or do we not have facts in dispute since it was a motion for summary judgment?
It is our position, Your Honor, that we don't. Unlike my opponent in this case, I've been involved in this case since its beginning, almost 10 years ago. And in that time...
Can you point me to the facts?
Yes, sir. The evidence in this case, and admittedly, a lot of it is derived from a declaration from our client, but there's never anything offered to rebut it. The other side never even submitted her own affidavit to rebut or dispute any of the claims at issue herein. Our client submitted an affidavit. It was supported by the facts of which, most of which, were actually vetted and adopted in the Taiwanese proceedings. She also brought household registration records that showed that she lived with the decedent in that house in Taiwan. And as a result of that, the legal ramifications of which is that the property here is community property.
The one party was not involved in the Taiwanese proceedings, so it's kind of difficult to apply, say, some type of estoppel against her as to the findings in that proceeding, even though some of them do bear fruit on the various relationships, and I understand that.
Yeah, and my response to that is that appellant would not be a party to the proceeding because she is an outsider to the marriage. In Nevada and in Taiwan, she would never be a party to the proceedings. And her rights flow directly from the Taiwanese court's finding that my client was the legal spouse, and that there was, in fact, an existing and ongoing marriage as between the decedent and my client. Again, that court also found, Your Honor, and they do often make light of this, but they had six children together. They were found to be married in 1964, and over the next 13 years, they had six children together, one of whom was born.
We don't miss that fact, counsel, but I mean, not the facts is they got married, they didn't record it, they did have the kids. There's a second marriage, it's alleged, it did get reported timely. The Taiwanese government, the court made their findings. But in equity and fairness, I'm looking at the laws here in the states, and more specifically the state of Nevada, don't we take into consideration that? And there's writing both ways as to the putative doctrine.
And I believe, Your Honor, that you are correct, and the end result does achieve that. Under the putative spouse doctrine cases, what you find is the best case scenario is that the putative spouse would get a one-half community property interest, the interest that belongs to that husband. And in this case, that's exactly what happens. So by virtue of his estate plan, and we've never challenged that, what they're trying to do, which is really inequitable, Your Honor, is they're trying to say that somehow her rights supersede the preexisting relationship. But there's no case law that would actually allow that to happen. She doesn't get to somehow absorb my client's legal rights to her half of the one community of the community property. In fact, the majority of the case law states that a putative spouse in this situation only has a right to an interest in the separate property of the decedent, not even a community property share. Which makes this unique is that he had an estate plan. Under Nevada law, he was free to devise his one-half community property interest to whomever he chose, and he chose to do that to a company.
So is that a concession from your standpoint on behalf of your client that there was separate property involved? Thus, we have this division of half interest?
We've never wanted to overstep. We looked at the law, and I think the law is very clear on this issue, that he had a right to devise his one-half of the community property, and we don't dispute that. We don't dispute the estate planning.
Let me ask you this. Does the doctrine of constructive fraud come into play here at all in the judge making his determination as to the interest in the house?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And that issue, first of all, was never raised. But there was no fraud on the part of my client. I don't think that there was anything in the records to suggest that she didn't, that the appellant in this case wasn't aware of that relationship. I think she was definitely on notice. I mean, the fact is that there's findings in there that there was an ongoing relationship between the decedent and my client, his spouse, mm-hmm. and their children. Their children even lived in Las Vegas, at times with the appellant herself. So I think that she at least was on inquiry notice that there was something going on.
But if you're married to one individual and there's a presumption that everything acquired during marriage is community property and you enter into some type of an agreement where you take someone you're not married to and give to them half of an interest in what would be community property in this purchase of this home, does that come into play at all?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I believe that in the Nevada statute, it does provide that basically he had an obligation to join my client as his legal spouse in any gift of property, and that any gift of property would be void as against public policy and against statute because she did not join specifically in the gift of that portion of her community property.
Which goes then back to the issue. The proceeds that came out of Taiwan to Nevada, were they joint or were they separate?
And I understand that, Your Honor, but I think the most important thing to remember here is that our client did submit competent evidence in the form of an affidavit with personal knowledge that was never rebutted by the other side. They never even submitted so much of an affidavit.
And why don't you recite what was in that affidavit to the court? The salient points of it.
My client met her husband in 1964. My client then purchased, she was working at the time, she was a working woman. She purchased the home with the decedent using money both from her job but also from a loan from her mother, and that is attested to in the declaration. That home was eventually sold. And the decedent took the proceeds of that sale to Nevada, and by the way, he went by himself without either party, without either wife in this situation, to establish the motel business.
And under the laws in Taiwan, how was that property titled?
It was titled, the land was titled in his name. There's no dispute about that. But I think that the issue here before the court is that this case was a Nevada case against a Nevada resident under Nevada law.
The court understands that, but we have this intertwined. We can't disregard the underlying law and the domicile of these individuals before they came to this country. You want us to rewrite and impose Nevada law on Taiwan. We can't do that. But we do have to be conscious of what our law is when we sort this out on the back end.
Your Honor, what I will say to that is, in Taiwan, the findings were that she was the married spouse, that they lived together. The Taiwan court did not, and was not asked.
Taiwan's court's ruling and what was being asked of whether this was a valid marriage in Taiwan. I get that. And I also get the fact that the second wife was not a party to that court proceeding. Is that correct?
She was not a party, Your Honor, but she could not have been a party.
So the legal ruling was not necessarily binding on her, but it is information the court can take knowledge of, and I understand that.
I actually do believe, Your Honor, with all due respect, that it was binding on her only because upon a finding that that was the legal and valid marriage, that those rights flow from that decision.
Well, then we get into really situations of then should we accept that ruling, because then your notice, opportunity, and things of that nature, basis of why we should accept the Taiwanese finding, come into play.
Yeah, I would say that they were. I think that the other side has stopped from even challenging that judgment. They were the one that selected Taiwan to be the forum in which to determine the validity of the Taiwanese marriage.
And by the way,
the husband, but in concert with the appellant. She was there every step of the way. She was there during all the proceedings. So I don't think that it was something that it was some kind of frolic and detour on behalf of the decedent spouse that he actually went out and did that. I mean, she was involved in this, and she's relied on representations that he made in that proceeding as well in to her favor, so, or attempted to. I only have about 30 seconds in closing, so unless you have any other questions, I just want to make a few couple of remarks in summation. You know, the court should uphold the district court's decision because the appellant really raised no issue of law or fact that would have precluded the entry of summary judgment in this case. You know, our court, my client has gone through 10 years of litigation to try to get to this point. And she's been affirmed every step of the way. And we would appreciate if this court would validate and give her the justice that she finally deserves. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Your Honor, quickly in response to your question about whether laches was alleged as an affirmative defense, it was. You can find that on page 10 of the joint appendix. So I'd like to move from there to talk about the facts in dispute with regard to the marriage between Mr. and Mrs. Chen. While we did not submit an affidavit, there are evidences in the record of tax returns filed by the two of them jointly. There's affidavits from both relatives and an employee of the motel saying that Mrs. Chen was known as the wife, represented herself as the wife of Mr. Chen. There are immigration records showing that when Mr. Chen came to the United States in 1979, he immediately sought a visa for his family, Mrs. Chen and their children. There's also their Taiwanese household registration. All of that disputes the account by respondent in her affidavit.
Was all this demonstrated to the Taiwanese court?
It wasn't relevant. The Taiwanese court never looked at the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Chen.
Okay.
It basically looked at whether the 1964 alleged marriage met the requirements of an open ceremony. Was it in an open courtyard? Did they do things like bow to the ancestors and light firecrackers? And were there more than two witnesses? That's all they looked at. With regard to respondents' arguments about putative spouse and whether that those cases permit a second wife to share in the community property with the first wife, I would point the court to the Sousa versus Freitas case cited in our briefs, as well as the Aetna case cited in our briefs. Particularly with regard to Aetna, while it doesn't mention putative spouse particularly, that's clearly what it's doing, is dividing property equitably between two spouses. And in that case, the court made a very equitable determination that where there is no community, where two people do not live together, never represent themselves as being married, which is exactly what happened here, there can be no community property. So I would point this court to that example. So it is simply not true that the putative spouse doctrine does not allow a first and second wife to share.
But under Williams, and again, when you're talking about a putative spouse, does it have any effect on a bigamous marriage, or is it void?
Putative spouse is applied in a case where the marriage is void or voidable. So the court would need to make that determination to apply putative spouse.
Does Williams give us any direction? Are you familiar with Williams?
I am, of course. Of course, Your Honor. Williams gives us limited direction, I'll just be honest, because the factual circumstances of this case are so unique. What Williams tells us is that putative spouse applies here. It tells us that the purpose of the putative spouse doctrine, which is to permit a spouse with a void or voidable marriage who acted in good faith and was actually thought they were married to someone, to share in the community property.
Good faith was never fleshed out down below, was it?
That's right, but good faith is presumed. Good faith is presumed.
Well, there's a little more to that.
It's also disputed.
Counsel, let me end in your remaining time, and I'd ask you to actually go over it. With everything being said and done, was the district court and the probate commissioner right for the wrong reasons, that even if this was sent back, is this how we're going to get anyway, a 50-50 split?
Absolutely not. And that is based on the unique facts of this case. Mrs. Chen married Mr. Chen in 1971. They registered their marriage legally in 1972. They immigrated to the United States within months or briefly within years of each other. They had children together. She worked at that motel property. She still works there today. She's been working there for 40 years, almost 40 years. And under those unique circumstances, I would argue that the principles of the Aetna court should apply here and that she should get everything. That would be my argument. That may not happen, but that's our position here. So there would be a difference. In a short answer, there would be a difference. Absolutely. Anything else?
Colleagues? All right, well, thank you both for it's an interesting case with lots of twists and turns, really interesting issues. Thank you for the briefing on this. It was well done. And we will let you guys move along for the next case.